Our constitutional democracy is on the line as we approach the November 3 election. President Trump and his enablers are doing what they can to undermine the perceived legitimacy of the election, lying about the integrity of mail-in voting, undermining the ability of the U.S. postal system to deliver ballots in time to be counted, purging voter rolls, using the COVID-19 crisis to limit polling places, especially in communities of color, and preventing congressional briefings about foreign interference in our election. President Trump himself has refused to state that he will leave office in a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election, and has threatened swift repression of post-election protests.
So what can we do? Poor, savvy activists have thought a lot about this question. They've used their experiences, living through coups in repressive countries, and observing what tactics work to oppose dictatorial behaviors. Together, they wrote a very detailed handbook that encourages activists to prepare ahead of time to be ready to respond. Their Hold the Line Guide to Defending Democracy offers specific local steps that activist communities like Wilf can take to prepare.
Chief Ashaw, you are the designated spokesperson, but all three of your mics will be open, so feel free to comment. Can you tell us a little bit about how your activist experiences led you to write this guide, and how the four of you came together, and what your process was?
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me all right? I'm going to take silence as a yes.
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. I've never used Maestro before, and this is such a cool tool, so this is exciting to be here at your conference tonight at Wilf, and also I'm really thankful for you all opening up space to have this conversation. I really appreciated the announcements in the beginning. Those are really great reminders going into the election, especially considering the scenarios that we wrote about. And some of the things that have brought us here, I think, you know, back in June, the four of us got together and we didn't really know each other very well at all. I didn't know Unker or Hardy at all. I had known Miriam from before, and each of us maybe only knew one other person, but collectively we had never worked together. And we got together because we wanted to think through some pretty daunting questions that became very clear were going to be important to consider for November. But also it's also very clear that this year is unlike, you know, any year that many of us have ever seen before. And I think a lot of our elders will even say, you know, it's unlike any year that even they have seen before, no matter how long they've been in movement work. So it became pretty clear that there was not going to be anything normative about the election, especially because at that point, we had already seen that Trump was foreshadowing certain things that were signals and sort of warning signs. And so we delved into a lot of questions thinking about, you know, what is it that's going to happen? And if any of these things happen in terms of the scenarios, what can we do about it? And you know, how do we start? So this guide was originally meant to be, honestly, we intended for it to be 10 pages, 20 pages max, and it's nearly 100. But I really urge you and really do recommend that you read it if you can. So it's broken into four parts. Part one focuses on really the critical actions that people can take from now until Election Day, November 3rd, to ensure a successful election. And part two gives background on the potential scenarios that can play out now, between now and Election Day, play out from Election Day to Inauguration Day. So that's January 20th to the 20th. So from Election Day, November 3rd to January 20th. And then part three really goes into a four-step process, especially, you know, this part three was in consideration. You can hold the slides at the beginning. I'll jump into the slides in a minute, but I just want to let folks know what's the overview of all the four parts of the guide, because it is a bit dense. So part three is for especially everyday folks or people who haven't really been able to organize a lot. This part breaks down into a four-step process, how you can start an election protection group in your community and in your city, and you can begin planning actions to protect democracy now. And so part three really goes into sort of how to organize. And then part four takes an in-depth look and analysis at the model of change that we draw on, which is from the field of nonviolent civil resistance. And that honestly has informed the entire thinking behind our guide and in terms of how to respond if there are attempts to subvert the election results. So now I'll hop into what is it that we present in sort of like part one and two of the guide. So the scenarios. So hopping into these slides now, on the next slide, you see the breakdown of the two main phases that I mentioned. So we know that in phase one, we're going to see that from November 3rd to December 4th, there's going to be a focus at more of a local and state level to certify the results, right? So we know that, you know, during this time, there's going to be vote counting happening at the state level, and the governor of each state is meant to certify those results and send them to Congress. And in phase two, from December 14th until January 20th, we know that the focus is going to be more towards the federal government, and after they'll receive those results in each state, then Congress will have to count and certify the votes by January 6th. So we know that, you know, if there are issues with any of those vote counts, then there's potential room for adjudicating those results. What I want to emphasize is that phase one at the, you know, local and state level is a really important place for especially us to focus as activist organizers and advocates, because, you know, if we begin to work on these scenarios and potential scenarios now, then we have a lot that we can do at our local and state levels to ensure integrity in the process. And on our next slide, we hop into sort of a summary of all of the election scenarios, right? So scenario one, and I'll break things down a little bit further in the following slides, but scenario one that we talk about in the guide is that the election day results will be unclear and Trump may declare victory anyway. So on the day of November 3rd, we know that it's not likely that there will be a clear winner. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily likely, especially considering absentee ballots. And so given that those may need to be counted, we know that what might happen is Trump could just declare himself the winner on election night. And in scenario two, the election results could show significant irregularities or signs of tampering, but Trump could still declare victory. So there could be major irregularities in the election results, you know, possible vote hacking and manipulation of vote counting. But with those irregularities, you can also anticipate that on election night, Trump will still declare himself winner. And then the last scenario that we talk about in the guide is that Trump may lose the election but refuse to leave office. And that means that, you know, the official results on election night or shortly after will show that Trump is a clear loser, but, you know, he could still refuse to concede, and that might cause, you know, claims for voter fraud, which we've heard foreshadowing of already, even though there's no evidence. And so hopping into the scenarios on the next slide in a little bit more detail, or first let me go into our model of change. And as I mentioned, we're, you know, deeply rooted on this guide in nonviolent civil resistance. And what's really important to know here is that we draw lessons from how ordinary people have really pushed forward democracy and won against authoritarians and authoritarian-style rulers in all parts of the world. And we apply those lessons to the current situation that we're seeing in the U.S. That doesn't mean necessarily that the U.S. is an authoritarian system, but it means that we see Trump as, you know, authoritarian. So how civil resistance works, right? So we know that power holders really depend on the obedience of their orders to be carried out. So nonviolent tactics like strikes, boycotts, and non-cooperation, and a lot of other actions can shift obedience patterns and also then the balance of power. On the next slide, let's hop into what these contested election scenarios are. And I just also want to take a minute to recognize that, you know, this is a lot of information, and so we're happy to discuss and, you know, any questions that folks have after we present this. So the next slide shows the first scenario, and that is, as I mentioned, that election day results are unclear and Trump may still declare victory. That means that we know that it might show that, you know, there's no clear winner on election night because there still needs to be ballots counted. And because those last ballots usually do skew Democratic, you know, it might be that Trump leans on, that states that lean on, you know, towards, Biden may actually, not be given their due, account. And so we know that there might be also potential to sow confusion via foreign interference, and that there might be, you know, investigations into quote unquote voter fraud, even though, as I mentioned, there might not be significant evidence of fraud. So, you know, if there are court orders that are issued to stop ballot counting early in states or even vote counting machines being impounded, then those are also big warning signs. There might also be pressure on Republican-led states to not certify the results if Biden is the winner, or even certify competing results. But, you know, that's something that we could expect. So on the next slide, let's talk a little bit about, in this scenario, what are the opportunities, right, that we might see. So if we think about what role can we play, we know that what we can start to do is really demand that each vote be counted, and also you know, demand impartiality in that. And then we also know that there will be an opportunity to remind people here, especially when we think about narrative and messaging that should be pushed forward, especially because voter fraud claims will be pushed forward, right? So this will be an important place where we have to remind people that slow elections don't mean inaccurate ones. We know that voting is safe, secure, and that we can hold elected officials accountable. And that'll help us challenge and aggressively challenge voter fraud claims that the media or the internet might start to spew. And we also really will need to urge folks to resist, you know, peacefully. And that's also really important because Trump and, you know, his supporters do try to provoke violence, and that only helps them, as we know. So then the last thing that we might want to consider is that, you know, we want to elevate the voices and demands of local groups organizing in each of the contested states, and especially those who are the most vulnerable and at the front line. And that's something that we should always hold core to any of the responses that we try to create on these scenarios. On the next slide, we go into what are the things that we might expect from in the second scenario, right? So the second scenario is that election results might show significant irregularities or signs of tampering, and Trump still declares victory. So here we know that we should really try to support and normalize nonviolent protests materially and through messaging. This is the opportunity. Let's hop one slide back. I want to talk a little bit first about what we can expect, right? So here we know what we might be expecting is that right-wing media and foreign entities might use misinformation to subvert or contradict the evidence of inconsistent voter data. And we know that significant irregularities might look like unexpected delays, unexplained delays in reporting ballot counting, and simply that the numbers just won't add up, right? We also might expect that at federal, state, and local levels, there's interference or inaction by different representatives or actors to prevent fair and honest investigation. And here is, honestly, here in any of the scenarios really is that there is a threat for violence, and especially here, the military or the police might be called upon. And those are some of the things that we could expect in a situation like this. So let's hop to the next slide and go back to those opportunities. So the opportunities that we will have in this scenario are that, you know, we will need to really amplify and support and normalize nonviolent protests. So in any way that we can, and I know so many people have already been contributing to a lot of the movements, not just this year, but over time. So just continuing to do that supportive work. And then also, you know, if you already are sort of trained up and know how to organize, then to also, you know, and if you're not, then to learn how to do so, but then to train supporters who, you know, who might want to start getting involved, train them in how to protest peacefully with nonviolent discipline, and then to also pressure, you know, federal elected officials to support fair and independent investigations, to support state and local officials in key states, those battleground states, to help carry out investigations. And here there's, you know, potentially, you know, we could elevate or amplify sort of the voices from the Republicans who are calling for fair and due process, And then we could also partner not just with these larger organizations like Protect the Results, Choose Democracy, or overarching organizations, but just like starting to work really deeply and you know, more deliberately with people within our own communities on how to do this work right now and building from there. So in the next slide, we'll break down what the third scenario is, right? So the third scenario, what we can expect is that Trump loses the election but doesn't leave office, obviously making the transition period just really hard. So if we can go back to the slide, I think that we pulled, yeah, there we go. Oh, one slide next. So here we'll see a lot of the same tactics from the administration and the media and supporters as we did in scenario one. So we know that Trump supported media and foreign actors might drive an even stronger, you know, quote unquote voter fraud narrative campaign, especially in the very important initial hours and days after the election. So that means that that's going to put a lot of pressure on the Biden campaign to prove a negative, meaning that quote voter fraud did not happen, which is of course very hard to do. So in this scenario, those entities might also try to escalate violence in the streets to position Trump as the only candidate, right, as he always does position himself, who can actually provide, quote, unquote, law and order. The opportunities on the next slide that this scenario can present us with are, you know, a lot of the things that we will do in response to scenario one. So this scenario will also require us to be unified and publicly show support for election results in collaboration with partners, with local community organizations. And we also might need to, you know, reprioritize. So other, you know, the other priorities that we might have in our organizing might need to take a backseat because we might need to prepare here for a sustained struggle, given that this is a crucial, it'll be the transition period and it will be up for question. We need to have discipline and very, you know, committed hearts and minds here. So that might be what we need to do for an extensive period of time. And then this is also another place where we might want to amplify Republican voices calling for a peaceful transfer of power. And on the next slide, actually, I think this is all of the slides. So this is meant to just take everybody through the scenarios that we break down, sort of the what we expect to have happen potentially in those scenarios, and then also the opportunities that they might present. In terms of, you know, what are the things that we can start thinking of right now, that we can even start to address right now, and start to mitigate, you know, as soon as today, if we choose to. And that's, I'll stop.
Tifa, your guide focuses on the kinds of long-term relationship building and trust building that is very much a part of Wilf's own model of organizing. We're not usually the virtual one-and-done flash mob group that comes together for an action once and then never sees each other again. In the communities where we have branches, we've had a strong, recognizable presence at city councils, churches, boards of education, human rights and utilities commissions for years. So we take advantage of that familiarity to support allies and projects that protect democracy and advance peace. So we hope that we'll be able to use some of that local recognizability and cachet to support demonstrators, peaceful demonstrators, even if we ourselves can't be with them. You also address ways to grab the narrative in advance of these situations arising. And your guide had some great advice about connecting in advance with local allies, particularly the idea of identifying what you call spheres of influence and key power holders who can affect both the accurate counting of the votes and the way that the local police respond to peaceful protests. I'd like to ask you about, you know, what, how you might see volunteers like Wilf members taking advantage of those of that advice, and what it would actually look like.
I appreciate that question, and also that, you know, I love that we're on a call of folks who really do understand the importance of relational power building and how important it is for us to build, you know, long-term, trusting relationships with one another. I also appreciate that because, you know, moving into the period of any of these scenarios, that's what we're really going to have to rely on. And we're going to have to sort of call upon one another, if it, any of this does go down. And I think, you know, I think a lot of you have already probably seen the ways in which it's already transpiring, especially in certain local communities, right? So I think one thing, especially if you do go through the guide and you look at that part two section that you were referencing in, you know, the spheres of influence and then the power mapping, those exercises are really helpful for literally anyone, right, to start thinking through, well, oh my gosh, there are all of these scenarios that are a bit daunting. What is it that I can do, right? So your sphere of influence activity, you do that for each of the scenarios. You can start to like really think about, well, you know, I'm really involved in my local mutual aid efforts, and I have such a great group of people that I'm already in community with that are very organized and very active. So that's within my sphere of influence. And I also have people that I know at my local representative's office that I'm in touch with, and I go to some city council meetings, so I know my city councilors. So those are within my spheres of influence. But then, you know, there's people outside of my sphere of influence. For example, Trump. He's outside of my sphere of influence, and that's fine. Like, I don't need to be, he does not need to be within my sphere of influence, right, to do something about it. But once I start to think through who are the things or the institutions or the people that are outside of my sphere of influence, you know, what that activity is meant to do is to say, who can you bring in now? Like, who are the folks that you know, that you're in community with, your friends, your neighbors, your family, that are just as, you know, alarmed or very, like, really inclined toward action right now, that you can start bringing in, to really expand your sphere of influence, right? So then maybe you have your independent sphere of influence. Then as you create an election protection group, like we are calling them our Hold the Line team, once you create your Hold the Line team, you can really start to expand your sphere of influence for each scenario. And that can help you really understand how to take action. So the next part of that is, okay, so if we want to take action, let's think about power mapping, which is what you were referencing. So in power mapping, you start to think through, well, you know, I know that there's the attorney general or the governor that I really want to get pledged, right? I want to get a pledge from my attorney general or from my governor that our state will not submit any final count until every single vote is surely counted, right? And so even if it's like, so whatever your method for ensuring that that happens, so you know that your target or the person, the power holder that you're targeting is, you know, let's say the attorney general or let's say the governor, right? So the governor is the person I'm going to have as a power holder that we're going to collectively organize, you know, not against, but we're going to organize to hold accountable. So let's have, you know, 10,000 signatures on a petition online that we have signed and say, and submit it to the attorney general and say, we expect you to count every single vote before you certify any results. And, you know, knowing what's important about power mapping is that it's about figuring out who holds what power, right? And then really leveraging all that you can to make sure that they are held accountable and exercise that power in a just way, right? So once you and your team sit down and think through the power mapping exercise, it's really meant to say, well, what's your theory of change? How will you ensure that, you know, every ballot is counted at your state level? This is just an example. That doesn't have to be the actual campaign that you choose to do. And then next, it helps you decide the tactic. Is it going to be a petition? Is it going to be, you know, sort of like a demonstration? Is it going to be a call in action where you get hundreds of people to call them? So it's up to you all to decide what that looks like, but the entire you know, part of the guide that is dedicated to that is probably a lot of things that you're already familiar with as organizers, but this helps you orient it towards, you know, each of the scenarios.
Great. Well, right now I'd like to open this up to questions from our participants on the call. If there are folks who have questions for Keisha, could you raise your hands by pressing number one on your phone keypad? It's number one on your phone keypad. Okay. Okay, Judy.
Hi, this is Judy.
Yeah, Judy, go ahead. You have your mic is on.
Okay. I'm suggesting that people look up how to be poll watchers. You can contact your Board of Elections. I've been sending various emails from groups that are suggesting that people get training to be poll watchers. basically, it's because the stand and stand by call of President Trump to his supporters, which could mean that there would be sort of threatening presence, and we want to be a calming presence if people are attempting to vote at a polling place. And you can't be electioneering. You have to be a certain distance from the polling place, but you can be a presence of peace, so that if people are waiting and feeling threatened, you can reassure them. So okay. I'm looking into options for that and have written several ideas to our branch members.
Yeah, thanks, Judy. We know that during COVID-19, it's leading to a significant shortage of poll workers, and fewer poll workers means fewer polling places will be open, which is, of course, just another way of voter suppression. So if you can sign up to be a poll worker, there is a shortage right now, and without enough poll workers, there will be fewer polling places, which can decrease voter turnout. So if you are able to, please do sign up to be a poll worker. Of course, take the precautions that you feel are necessary and safe. There's certainly a huge need right now for poll workers.
Great. Robin Lloyd, you have a question. Your hand is up. Robin's calling from Burlington, Vermont.
Yes, hello. Thank you. Well, thank you for this explanation of the situation. However, I feel that you give three options, three possibilities, but you miss the major one, which is that the voting will be so overwhelmingly in support of Biden that there will be no possibility for these hijinks that Trump has in mind. So I think that's that ought to be the first option. I think that's the most likely option. Maybe I'm an optimist, but maybe I missed the early part of your presentation when maybe you said that, but I really think that should be presented as one of the four options, that there is no opportunity for them to play their game.
Sure. Yeah, I think that point is well taken. I mean, the fourth or another option could certainly be that Trump does not win, and that there is a peaceful transfer of power, and that is certainly an option. So one thing that I do want to say is that none of the scenarios that we present are mutually exclusive or the end all be all. They are the scenarios that came up time and time again in the research, which is why we wrote about them, because we really hope that people read it and understand the potential for kind of what usually in the American imagination doesn't seem like a possibility, right? So on June 1st, 2020, we saw Trump order members of the military to repress nonviolent demonstrations in Washington, D.C. And so after seeing that is when we decided that we needed to write about it. And it was an indication of the great length that Trump might go to just stay in office. So that's exactly where, this entire project started, is knowing that these repressive tactics are, very authoritarian in nature. And so the scenarios that we are drawing, up in the guide are to just help people see what are the potential ways that this could go and to prepare for them.
I guess I'm just saying that it almost provokes fear on the left when you only give those three options, whereas the main likely option is that we will totally overwhelm the vote for Biden, and we won't need to rely on these opportunities.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Well,
thank you, Robin.
Okay.
Yeah. Darian is the president of the U.S. section of Wolf. Darian's calling from Sacramento, California. Go ahead, Darian.
Thank you. I was just wondering, what is the level of national coordination, if any, and what is the mechanism for communities that are organizing to be prepared? Thank you.
Thanks. So there are a lot of ways that people are coordinating nationally. I'd say, so there's an organization that is called Protect the Results. And there are groups of folks from several organizations that have come together and partnered, from Indivisible to 360 Action to Daily Coast. This is a huge coalition of people who are working on a national level to ensure that the results are protected for the election. And so
we have their website on our text pad if anyone is looking for it.
Oh, fantastic. So there are different events that they will be hosting all across the country. They just launched today their map showcasing where those events are. And you can sign on to their pledge. And if you are an organization, of course, if you're part of an organization other than World, you can get the other organizations that you're part of to also sign on and partner. So I would say that there are national coordination efforts happening. But I do want to sort of emphasize and drive home the fact that what we need to immediately work on, like I mentioned in the beginning of the presentation, right, is like what can we do now at a local level to ensure that there's transparency all the way through, right? And so one of the ideas that somebody, I appreciate, like somebody brought up in the audience is, become a poll worker if you can. Register to vote. Register as many people as you can to vote if you can. Go ahead and do phone banking and get out the vote as much as possible. And then maybe also, start to think, well, should I create my own election session group? Should I create a hold the line team in my city? And then start to ask, at a state level, get a demand, a pledge and a commitment from my attorney general or from my governor to make sure that the results are only going to be verified when every vote is actually counted, and get my representatives to do the same, right? And so there are some other steps that we can take, which we outline in the guide, that you can really use to hold your elected officials and other power holders accountable to make sure that the results will be, fair.
Okay, we have a question from Barbara Stoller-Schulk from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi, I actually did live in Ann Arbor. Oh my God. I'm disconnected. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. I did live in Ann Arbor. I live in Boston, Massachusetts now.
Okay. What's your question? And I think we lost that, Barbara. Maybe she'll call back in. Okay. So let's see. Jane Brown?
Yes. I'm very concerned that Trump won't leave.
So are we all.
Who would take him out? He is very, very popular with the police.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Do you have an answer for her, Kipa? Jane said that she was worried about if Trump doesn't leave, who would be taking him out because he has the police on his side. That was, I think, what she said.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question there, Devin Jane. I think that the question is important and one I'm not going to even pretend I can answer, right? Like I think what I will say to that is sort of, I really think that the best thing that we can do right now is to sort of like, move with the, like, from where we're at within those spheres of influence that we have and grow those spheres of influence, beyond ourselves by bringing in, more people into our local organizing, into our like state organizing that we're going to start doing, or we already have started doing to ensure, a free and fair process, at the level that we know that we can hold accountable, right? So that's why I said in the beginning, Trump is outside of my sphere of influence. But let's say that we're talking about our, when we're talking about the military or about law enforcement, I totally hear you. I can't even start talking about how much I do not trust law enforcement, but I don't want to offend anyone here. But anyways, what I will say is that, there may be potential for those actors to work against, protesters or people who are working to hold the line. But what I really think we can do is maybe, also send a pledge or, ask for a sign on from law enforcement locally to say that they will not retaliate against peaceful protesters, that they will not attack peaceful protesters, as we've already seen them do all year. But what that does is that allows for us to gain clarity about where they stand and where, the organizing will be at. And then also, how, what we can start to call on as the next step, right? So if you have local law enforcement that will not sign on to say, to a pledge that says, hey, we're going to ensure that democracy is upheld and that the results are, transparent and fair and only every vote is counted and then it will be certified. If you have law enforcement that will hinder that, then that becomes a huge, that becomes a story. And that's like, let's call in some media on that. Like, let's draw attention to that way that it needs to be drawn to, right? And so I think that there's ways that we can, again, start to make certain demands right now of your local, like your representatives, your local law enforcement, your attorney general, your governors, to really put them in the position to answer.
Yeah, probably put together like a group of people representing different constituencies, churches, politicians, school, students, and approach the police together. I think if we did that in advance on a local basis, we might they may at least see that the people who are planning to be in the streets are not enemies. They're people who are citizens like them. Laura Dewey, you wanted a question. Are you there, Laura?
Yeah, can you hear me? Actually, Darian asked my question, and so while there was talking, and thank you for answering the question, I went online. I urge everybody to check out Protect the Results. You can sign up. And also, there are these wonderful trainings by George Lakey that is on the, I think, the Democracy one website. So there, those links on the page, on the Maestro page, are very helpful. Anyway, but I don't need to ask the question. Darian answered for me. Thank you.
Okay. Peggy Olson, I am from Monterey, California. Go ahead, Peggy.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm very concerned about the potential of electronic voting machines being hacked and in favor of Republicans. And I think this has happened many, many times. And because it isn't easily or at all detectable, it's of great concern. And I'm wondering if your group had thought about this.
We have thought about it. And we know that that is a potential, like I mentioned, foreign actors and the interference that they might cause online, as well as the sort of the potential for them to also disrupt what's going on with the actual results. So, they could sow confusion just amongst people in general through the internet, but then they can also, of course, affect maybe the results. But yes, these are things, again, that we do talk about in the guide as being factors. However, one thing that I do want to say about that is that that's such a valid concern and such an important, consideration. But it's also okay to know that we're not necessarily going to be able to impact every single concern, right? So what we can do is think about what is it that I can do right now from where I am to begin to ensure that the results will be as fair and transparent and sort of upheld to like a democratic level as possible, right? So I'll just have to say, like, I personally don't know what I would do about foreign interference or different actors that are not even in this country, maybe, or complete like online bots. I don't know what I would do about that. But what I do know is that in my community, I can, I'm working really deeply with my neighbors and mutual aid network to say, hey, let's all become poll workers. Hey, are you ever all registered to vote? Okay, now let's get the governor to sign this mandate and sign this pledge, right? That's what I can do right now. But I can't do anything about, the other considerations that are still important and very valid. So I recommend that people maybe think through, again, what are the spheres of influence that you occupy and how can you move from there?
Okay, Cheryl Spencer, you had a question. Cheryl's in Palo Alto, California.
Actually, it's less of a question, more of a comment. I heard the other day a news program, which would probably be PBS or NPR, that it would be the military who would go in and remove Trump if he would not leave the White House. It's very clear. It would have nothing to do with the local police. It would be a military action, probably ordered by Congress, and that would be what would happen, okay? Who in the military, they weren't clear, but I'm sure it's something everybody could look up and find out. So the local police in Washington, D.C. wouldn't have anything to do with it. The other thing is regarding interference through computers. This has been looked at very widely. Books have been written about it since 10 years ago, recommending to secretaries of state that they don't allow the net-connected polling stations, that they should ask that there be a paper copy printed out of what your vote was, and there'll be a paper trail if it is somehow or other a computer. So if the secretaries of state did their job the last 10 years and listened to the Association of Computing Machinery, which is the computer specialist professional society, and read the books about this, then they should have already set up places so that they cannot be tampered with at the actual polling station. And the other thing, of course, is to ask for a paper ballot, which in California every last person has received. I got mine 2 days ago, as promised. A paper ballot that you take a pencil or a black pen and you cross your little boxes, and then you hand it in at various places. That is a lot harder to tamper with. So the tampering with computers, you know, that should be have been dealt with by your secretaries of state who are in charge of polling activity.
Yes. If it hasn't by now, there's not much we can do about it. Ask for a paper ballot to be sent to you.
So I think some of this is fear mongering, and that people should not be so fearful. I'm sorry.
All right. Thanks, Cheryl. And our last question will be from Judy Adams in Palo Alto also.
Hi. It's also a comment. It's true that if the election results are certified and Biden is the winner, the military would eject Trump if he stayed in the White House as a trespasser. I think there are concerns, and being prepared for concerns is not doesn't need to be fearful, or the act of being prepared doesn't need to be fear-mongering. I think one of the best preparations, at least protections in California or states that provide this service, is that you can follow the progress of your paper ballot. And you can also find out if there is a question on your ballot. One of the problems, apparently, is when we first register to vote, that signature is held and compared to the signature on the outside of ballot documents. And if there's a discrepancy, in the state of California, if there's a discrepancy, you will be notified. So some people thinking, gee, I'm in my 70s, and when I registered, I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
To be prepared, and not in a fearful way, but as a prepared person, to be peaceful, nonviolent, is a good thing. So I would encourage people to, if they are afraid or currently fearful or concerned about mailing a ballot, take it to the polling place where it will be secure. Worse things could happen. Ballot boxes that are on corners could be stolen. That's why I suggest that volunteers, peaceful volunteers, in addition to trying to be poll workers, be poll watchers, that you watch if there's in-person voting. You stand as a peaceful citizen witness to be sure that there aren't any challenges given as people wait in line.
Just remember to wear your mask.
Wear your mask. And if there's a box near your city hall or on some corner, stand by that box with a mask peacefully, and make sure that there's no hanky-panky there. So I think we need to be cautious, but not fearful. I agree very much.
I'd like to add, thanks, Judy. I can do that. So nothing about this is meant to be fear-mongering. This is actually, again, like if you're able to read the guide, we really recommend that you do go to holdthelineguide.com and you can take a look at the guide. They're really deliberately we've drawn out sort of red flags that you might want to consider, just to keep your eye on, you know, what are the things that might occur that might push you towards certain action? What are the lines that you want to hold? Those are very clearly also drawn out. A couple of things that I heard, one is that we've drawn up sort of a campaign plan, a campaign planning guide, a commitment to upholding democracy, and what we demand from elected officials, the police, and the military. I will send that to Mary Beth after the call, and you all can also take a look at that. There are, we draw out exactly how you can make demands, what tactics that you can use, a lot of resources that you can also turn to. We're also doing trainings on, if you're interested in starting to organize, we're doing those trainings already. If you go to holdthelineguide.com, you can sign up for our trainings that we're having for how to start organizing, locally. And, I really appreciate, what I think Judy was mentioning that, you know, it's just always good to stay aware. And the reason why we created this guide is that, folks can just be in the know, because, once we know, then we can move forward, together and with power. And, we also are deeply rooted in reality, right? There have been many red flags this year alone. And if not, you know, throughout the entire administration and, throughout history, that allow us to like draw from those lessons and again, move forward with knowledge and towards, you know, a powerful togetherness. And that's the entire intention. So I really hope that you can check it out at holdthelineguide.com.
Kifa, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us and the work that you and your colleagues did creating the Hold the Line Guide, and for coming to be on our call tonight. Having the resources that you prepared with the deep thinking you've done to prepare the American people for what lies ahead really helps us navigate the uncertainty ahead in these pretty unthinkable circumstances for most of us. You're welcome to remain on the call or drop off if you have other commitments, but we invite you to stay connected with Wilk in the future.
Certainly will. Thank you so much for having us again. Really appreciate everyone's time, and keep in touch. Take care.
Definitely. Thank you
so much.